Welcome to The Deduction, your guide to the complex world of tax and economics. Hi, my name is Scott Hodge. I'm president of the Tax Foundation and your host on today's episode. Today, we're going to talk about how the tax code treats business investments in research and development, otherwise known as R&D. And I'm joined by two of the Tax Foundation's top economists and analysts, Erica York and Garrett Watson. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, well, this is a particularly timely discussion, say the least, considering all the huge investment that many pharmaceutical companies have made in COVID vaccines and other PPP equipment. And we've had a huge discussion in the U.S. that's, I think, going to continue throughout this about the onshoring of supply chains and the fact that many Americans feel that we just weren't prepared for this and we need more R&D and these kinds of things. And then, of course, we have the effects of the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, in which beginning next year, companies are going to have to start amortizing their R&D expenses rather than deducting them. And that will be a big sea change in that regard. So there's a lot on the horizon here. But before we get started, I do want to kind of maybe set the stage, if you will, with two quick anecdotes, just to kind of get our discussion going. First, and this goes back, gosh, almost 20 years, I guess, shortly after I joined the Tax Foundation, I was speaking to a senior tax executive for a tech company in Silicon Valley. I won't tell you who, because I don't want to embarrass them. We were talking about the R&D tax credit. And back then, the R&D tax credit had to be renewed every year. And he spent a lot of time lobbying here in Washington to get it renewed because it meant so much to the company's tax bill. So you can imagine how mortified he was when the CEO of his company was interviewed by reporters about the R&D tax credit. And they asked how much the credit factored into their business plans. And the CEO said, well, not at all. They invest where it makes sense, irrespective of the tax. Well, this poor guy had put all of his, you know, his lobbying chits into the R&D credit, only to have his boss pull the rug out from under him. So he was pretty upset about that. Well, flash forward, you know, even today, still talking to corporate tax VPs, you hear about how complicated the credit is to comply with. And they're always puzzled by sort of the mixed messages they get from Washington, where on the one hand, politicians talk a lot about how we want to incentivize R&D in America and so forth. And yet, when these companies get audited, the IRS questions every expense that they try to put into the R&D bucket. So here on the one hand, we're supposed to be promoting R&D, then the IRS turns around and denies their deduction. So where are we to go from here? Well, with those two stories as a backdrop, let's begin our discussion. So maybe we could start with Erica to talk about why R&D matters, how an economist thinks about this and spillovers and so forth. And then maybe Garrett, you can tell us, how does the tax code currently treat research and development? So, Erica, kind of kick us off and tell us, why does R&D matter in the first place?
Yeah, so research and development is important in part because we think there could be positive spillovers from research and development. So we always hear, you know, innovation is kind of a buzzword, but innovation is good. It can lead to technological breakthroughs. It can increase productivity. All these things are good things that contribute to economic growth. And so the case of the tax treatment for R&D gets into some interesting questions that I think Garrett and I will both talk about. First is the question of how do you just treat the expense? Do companies get to deduct it immediately? Do they have to amortize it over time? And then there's also the question of if there are these positive spillovers, if there are benefits that accrue outside of what the people who are engaging in research and development would get. There could be a case for subsidizing it, because then without the subsidy, we might not have the optimal amount of R&D happening. Those are kind of the reasons for thinking about how do we treat just the deduction, and then should we provide any extra benefit for research and development within the tax code?
So, Garrett, how over time, how is the U.S. tax code treated this?
Well, over time, R&D expenses have generally been permitted to be expensed and deducted. Of course, with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, R&D expenses are fully deductible right now. And starting in 1981, in addition to the depreciation treatment of R&D, There is also that additional incentive to invest through the R&D tax credit. And that was first established in 1981 as part of the Tax Act then. It actually expired at the end of 1985 before being updated and brought back as part of the Tax Reform Act in 1986, and then was updated and extended in fits and starts between 1986 and 2015 before being made a more permanent part of our tax code through legislation in 2015 known as the PATH Act, which provided a bit more stability in the tax code as it relates to the R&D tax credit. And in terms of the size of the tax credit, the Joint Committee on Taxation has estimated it reduces tax revenue by about $12 billion in 2020 and is set to mostly impact the corporate side of things, about $10.6 billion. And then on the individual side, including pass-through firms, it's about $1.2 billion. And that's over and above the expensing treatment that R&D also gets on the depreciation side of the tax code.
So following up on Erica's point, the tax code is kind of subsidizing twice. I mean, is it way to think about it? Or, I mean, the same amount of investment is getting both the deduction and potentially a credit. So do I understand that right?
That's right. The same expense can receive both a full and immediate deduction and to some extent also an R&D tax credit. There are rules in the tax code which prevents full double dipping, where you can fully expense the value of the investment in addition to receiving a tax credit. But the explicit goal that policymakers have decided on is to provide a net subsidy in the tax code for research and development, with the hope that that would increase R&D spending and ultimately greater innovation in the U.S. And of course, a big question there is whether or not it actually does so. And there's some interesting points there in the data.
Well, Erica, getting back to my story of my poor tax VP who was lobbying on behalf of the R&D credit. Is this basically a deduction for expenses that might have happened anyway?
I think in some cases, the credit could be subsidizing activity that would occur, whether the credit existed or not. I mean, if we think of it in our current context, I don't think in the absence of an R&D tax credit, we wouldn't have seen pharmaceutical companies trying to design a vaccine for the coronavirus. I think those activities would happen. So I think there are some cases of probably subsidizing activity that would have happened anyway. I think Garrett's taken probably a closer look at some of the literature on this and could go into that.
Yeah. What do you see in the literature there? You kind of have to wonder whether, because the R&D credit was on again, off again for so many years, how much it really impacted that sort of investment, or because of the lack of stability, I guess, or predictability, I suppose.
Yeah. Interestingly, the literature on R&D tax credits does bear this out a little bit. The literature tended to find smaller effects of the credit earlier on. So you look at investment in R&D in the 80s and 90s, and you try to relate that to changes in the credit, and the effects even on spending were fairly small, but they actually have gotten larger in the past couple of decades. And part of the reason why that might be the case is because the credit has, of course, now been made permanent in the past 6 years. And along the way, policymakers have made some tweaks to expand the access of that credit, make it a little easier to apply for that credit via a simplified version of the credit that's available to smaller firms. And so that might be increasing the effects on R&D spending. And then the big question is, even if you can relate it to spending, does that actually increase total innovation, right? Because you could see a situation where increased spending doesn't actually increase innovation. In fact, there was an interesting argument that some of the credit's value is actually captured by higher wages for scientists, engineers, and the folks engaging in this work. One estimate was that the credit's impact was actually blunted by something between 30 and 50% because wages were being bid up for folks who were working in the context of this credit. And so that is something to consider when you think about the total effect of that credit on innovative activity.
I seem to remember that there's some odd quirks or complexity in this, and that if this isn't intended to incentivize marginal investment or the next level of investment, that level was benchmarked at like 1985 or something like that. What do you know about that? And how does that make any sense whatsoever if you're a startup firm today?
So the way that the regular R&D tax credit is offered is as a percentage of how much a company's R&D spending exceeds a certain base amount. And one of the base amounts is their history of research spending since 1981.
So
a lot of these firms didn't exist back then. And so there have been other types of calculations offered for firms that don't have that history of research and development spending. So there's an alternative simplified credit that firms can take that is equal to a base of their research expenditures over 3 years. And then for companies that don't even have that, there is a credit. It's 6% of the current year's qualified research expenditures. So what we end up with is this really kind of messy structure of at least three different calculations that companies have to go through to determine what their base level of spending is and then what credit they get depending on that base.
Well, that doesn't seem to make sense, at least from a simplicity standpoint. Are there countries that seem, I know you're doing a paper on this with a colleague, and as you look around the globe, are there other countries that seem to be doing this in a more simplified manner, one that at least reduces the complexity or compliance costs?
That's a good question. And that's something our colleague Daniel Bond on the global team has also been looking into closely. And what his team finds is that when you look at the 37 member countries in the OECD, that a lot of these tax credits and special rules are fairly common. Another common provision that's included in many countries is what's known as a patent box, where there are tax incentives for moving your patented IP, other forms of IP into the country. And so out of those 37 countries, about 20 have special deduction rules for R&D costs, 18 have a tax credit for R&D, and 19 have some sort of patent box. And of course, the rules vary ranging from their definitions of what kinds of R&D costs are applicable, their deduction amounts, the credit rates, and the eligibility rules are all varying there. But two countries really do stand out to have a slightly different approach, and that's Estonia and Sweden. So one in Eastern Europe and one in Northern Europe, where they don't have any of those policies, actually. Instead, they offer a slightly different approach where they offer broadly competitive and relatively neutral tax systems in the business side compared to their OECD peers, which does have some benefits in terms of simplicity and longer run growth. And it's effectively a bet that, yes, they're not subsidizing R&D, but that is made up for the fact that their tax codes are simpler to comply with and have a bit more stability for long run growth.
Can we get back to the patent boxes? Because from what I understand, this would essentially subsidize or offer a tax break for both sides of the investment equation, right? So the R&D credit or some sort of a R&D preference would subsidize the upfront investment. And then the patent box is essentially rewarding the patent that comes out of that investment. So it's essentially getting two levels of tax benefit. Do I understand that correctly?
That's right. And they're very often paired together where you are getting those mutually related benefits by investing in a particular country. And the hope really is that you're going to often just attract R&D or patents and IP that either already exist or may exist in the future, where companies may have many options for where they may locate their IP. So sometimes with R&D policy, you have two goals that are often related but distinct, right? One is incentivizing greater innovation in your own country, hoping that will spur greater competitiveness and growth. And then also sort of a more closer to a zero-sum game where you're trying to attract shifting R&D spending. So that's one way to sort of think about or conceptualize the difference between a patent box and some of these other subsidies, which are both trying to take the share of the pie from other countries potentially, but then also grow the pie for everyone in your country specifically.
Well, I don't mean to sound snarky, and I will, but I think France has both R&D credit and a patent box, and that doesn't seem to have helped them attract much capital investment in technology and whatnot. Otherwise, they wouldn't be trying to tax U.S. companies through their digital services tax. But it is interesting, though, how the Europeans have, well, and especially through the OECD and their some of their BEPS work, have tried to at least enforce rules that require some physical nexus between the activity and then taking advantage of something like a patent box. So in the old days, you just used to park that piece of paper, which was with a patent in the country, you know, much like, you know, those, mailbox things that you hear about in Bermuda and what have you. And then you could take advantage of the patent box. But now you actually have to put a lab or an R&D facility there in order to take advantage of it. So that at least solves some of that games playing that used to happen when companies would just kind of shift things around to take advantage of those rules. Erica, how could we go ahead and or try to simplify our system to make it at least track real investment, to be simpler to both comply with and obviously for the IRS to administer, and then one that would probably actually work? Is there a system out there, or should we just scrap it? And you've done a lot of work on expensing, obviously, and is that just kind of the solution for everything?
Yeah, so two things come to mind. First is to make sure that we're treating the depreciation deductions or the expensing side of things the right way. This year we are. Companies can still deduct their R&D expenses, but starting next year that will switch and domestic R&D will have to be amortized over 5 years. I think first we need to cancel that. If we allow that switch to happen and companies have to amortize their R&D costs, that's going to increase the after-tax cost of making R&D investments, which kind of moves in the completely opposite direction of what we're trying to do with an R&D tax credit. So I think writing that side of the equation first makes sense. Then when we're looking at the R&D tax credit, there have been several proposals, especially in the wake of COVID, for changing the R&D tax credit, for making it more accessible to startups or smaller firms. I think one of the ways that could be done is moving completely to that alternative simplified credit structure. So rather than having these different formulas and percentages and calculations based on different base amounts, move to one simplified structure. I think that would help things. There are also expansions that can be made for small businesses. Right now, the R&D tax credit can offset up to, I think it's $250,000 in payroll tax liability. So looking at expansions like that, that could help pre-revenue firms would be one way that it could be expanded as well.
Interesting. Can you go, you've done a lot of, you've used our tax model to analyze the effects of amortization. What does that look like from an economic perspective?
Yeah, so it would be pro-growth to cancel amortization of R&D. It's going to be one of the options that we put in our options guidebook that's going to be coming out later this year. We estimate that it would increase long-run GDP by about 0.2%, and it would increase the long-run capital stock by about 0.4%. It would cost somewhere around $130 billion over 10 years to cancel that change.
But the upside is the economic benefit. So, you know, it's a small loss to the Treasury, so to speak. Well, I mean, the Treasury's not getting anything from it now. But, I mean, it's a small loss prospectively to the Treasury in exchange for better economic growth.
That's right. It's one of the more pro-growth types of tax changes you could make when you're talking about aiming a tax change right at capital investment. And it's only going to benefit those firms that are engaging in R&D spending. So firms that are growing or that are new are more likely to take advantage of something like an expensing deduction.
You know, it's interesting. I was contacted recently by a business owner in New Jersey as a small tech firm. And New Jersey actually has a program by which tech firms and small pharma companies can sell their R&D credit, their unused R&D credits, as well as their unused NOLs, net operating losses, in order to raise liquidity to put back in their business. So they're essentially selling those unused credits because chances are when you're a startup, you're not making any profits and you can't use the credit. But they're selling it to a company that does have excess capital and needs the deduction. And it's a way of sort of churning these things back into these smaller firms to give them the liquidity and capital that they need to continue to grow. It's a very innovative program. It's relatively small. And this fellow is trying to get it adopted here at the federal level as part of the next COVID bill. And I find that very interesting as an alternative.
I think that is really interesting. I mean, one of the general detriments for startups in the tax code is that if you make a profit, you're subject to an immediate tax liability. But if you make a loss, you're not necessarily entitled to an immediate tax benefit. If you don't have those revenues yet, and most startup firms don't start up having revenue in the first year, they turn a loss for several years before they make a profit. They might have to wait to take advantage of those tax credits. And so policies like that one you mentioned, as well as using your R&D tax credits to offset something besides income tax liability, like payroll tax liability, is helpful for those firms.
Yeah, all these incentives in the world don't help you if you don't have any profits, I guess. Garrett, what's the Biden administration saying? What do you see in your crystal ball? What are they saying about these kind of policies? What are the implications of that?
There are a few things I think the Biden administration is thinking about and campaigned on last year. And that is an understanding and an interest in the U.S.'s broader position with research and development, particularly as it relates to international competition and the need for greater spending in R&D. But the broad approach that they've taken, broadly speaking, is an emphasis on the spending side for R&D, particularly basic R&D. There is an interest, for example, in using that in the context of a recovery plan that succeeds this first $1.9 trillion rescue plan later in the year. And the second thing they're thinking about is using more targeted methods in the tax code, carrots and sticks, if you will, to incentivize greater, not just onshoring of manufacturing and other productive activity, but also activity like R&D in the hopes that will entice more of that in the United States rather than broader tax changes that may serve as similar tools. And this is part of a broader trend that policymakers are considering, which is really a more narrow carrot and stick approach for research and development incentives. And that's going to be, of course, the design details matter there a lot. It becomes, of course, very complicated to try to design something like that that's effective. We've seen with the R&D tax credit, which is a fairly broad provision, that is plagued with all sorts of complexity and effectiveness problems and access issues, particularly for smaller firms. And that's got to be something they're going to be weighing when they think about additional incentives on top of the existing system. The opportunity is for folks who are interested in pro-growth neutral tax policy is that there may be an angle there to convince them that something like canceling R&D amortization and simplifying these R&D credits is consistent with their vision here. And that this is a superior approach, at least for now, versus adding new carrots and sticks into the tax code.
Yeah, and Erica, you know, we've seen some various proposals crop up on Capitol Hill to try to incentivize manufacturing, you know, onshoring, whether it's offering pharma companies full expensing for building a building or something like that, or a new factory. Do you see a danger here in trying to target certain companies or sectors with these kind of incentives as opposed to just broadly essentially allowing the market to work?
Yeah, I think there's a few issues with constraining these policies to be for whether it's a certain sector or whether it's for onshoring specifically. One is that, like Garrett mentioned, it's just incredibly complicated. How do you define onshoring? Does it mean they literally have to pick up the exact same asset and move it to the United States? Does it mean just a net increase in their United States investment compared to where they're investing in the rest of the world? There's several measurement questions. And then there's also a question with something like R&D amortization or something like 100% bonus depreciation or full expensing for structures. Why would we offer that only to certain industries if we think that that's the right treatment? If we think that that's going to be effective at increasing investment, why constrain that to one small sector of the economy? So questions like that, I think, are really important to think through when we're talking about targeting policies just to one small sector versus making them broadly available. The complexity and the increase in investment should be something that we want to address for all businesses and for all investments.
Yeah, the political process isn't always good at picking winners and losers, is it? We've seen that over and over again where they've really missed the mark. It seems, too, that with the economy moving as quickly as it is, to adjust to sort of the new post-COVID world, the political process will be behind the curve, that the economy will be so far ahead of it. So it would seem to make sense, as you say, to have broad-based policy, allow things to work as they are, allow innovators to be innovative, and then get the political process out of the way. Garrett, where do we go from here? How do we get this process fixed or changed or move forward? How should people think about this so that Capitol Hill gets it right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the right question to ask. And I think in addition to the types of recommendations that we've talked about earlier, including, you know, simplifying the credit and canceling amortization, that there really does need to be a holistic conversation about the state of American dynamism and how we can encourage greater innovation through a holistic economic and tax program. There's a lot of course, trends pushing against American dynamism over the past few decades, and we have demographic factors that will make it even more challenging in the years ahead. And so really setting up our tax code in a more holistic sense to be in favor of innovation is going to be really important. And one trend or one thing that we're trying to tell policymakers is not to have tax code recommendations or policy that's at odds with one another. So if you really do want a tax code that's going to incentivize innovation, you don't want to undercut that by introducing policies, for example, large rate changes or increases in tax burdens elsewhere. They're going to cut against the very thing you're trying to accomplish. And so there may be a place in the tax code for special treatment of R&D as long as it's simple and broadly accessible, but you really can't make up for an uncompetitive tax code elsewhere with those types of incentives. And so I think that a holistic approach is going to be really important when we evaluate any sort of policy to ensure that we have a tax code that can encourage innovation.
Well, and the spillover effects, to Erica's point earlier, there are more spillovers than just the benefits of the technology from bad policies. We have what's called the incidence of these taxes. And when you look at things like when you've modeled these tax changes, the impact tends to be more than just the wealthy, for instance, or upper income people or shareholders, or what have you. Perhaps you could speak to that and how the downstream effects on average workers comes about from these policies.
Yeah, I think making these... Yeah,
either one of you. I know you've done modeling on those issues.
Yeah, I'm sure Erica has additional thoughts, but the one thing that comes to mind for me is, yeah, making these changes and these provisions tangible for folks and showing the translation from, you know, the provision for amortizing at R&D, how that actually impacts people's lives is really important. To bring back to the beginning of the conversation, Scott, your point about the vaccines and pharmaceuticals, I mean, that is one of the most tangible impacts that we're going to have on our lives in a very long time, right? And that is the ultimate sort of product or outcome of a series of decisions made by public sector and private sector stakeholders that includes a tax component in that. And so providing those real-world case studies and what it actually means to have a more dynamic and innovative society for everyone is really important. And as you say, in our modeling, the general result is that tax treatment that's more neutral and pro-competitive and pro-innovation tends to raise the wages of everyone across the income spectrum. And it goes even beyond that in that there's all sorts of benefits to innovative technology from, you know, the internet to pharmaceuticals that isn't captured in our income or GDP effects, right? The very fact that we might be able to see our loved ones soon in person regularly, it has value way exceeding the incomes that we might be able to capture in our modeling. So if anything, we often understate the effects of having a good tax code for encouraging innovation when we think about those total effects.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So Erica, when you see the downside or downstream effects on sort of the distribution of these, you know, say higher corporate taxes, so let's say we were to, administration were to allow the R&D credit to, or the deduction to become amortized, what sort of effects do you see that on your distributional tables? It ends up being, I would assume, an impact on lower income people as well.
Yeah, that's right. So when we're thinking about the corporate tax burden, that's not just limited to corporate shareholders. And even when we think of corporate shareholders, that's not just limited to the wealthy. That's people who have money in their 401ks and retirement plans that are invested in these businesses. But the burden is also going to fall on workers. When we have less investment in productivity enhancing tools, our workers aren't as productive. We don't produce as many things and as many services in the economy. And so wages don't grow as fast. If we increase tax burdens, our model shows that wages fall and that the burden of the tax is split between workers and between shareholders. So we can't just isolate the tax and think, oh, it's only going to affect the wealthy. We're all connected in the economy. And so it filters through and affects all of us. And Scott, you had an interesting blog post probably several months ago that looked at some of the research that's been done on bonus depreciation and how that affected workers across states that conformed to the federal provision and that didn't conform. and that found employment increases and some positive impacts on wages in states that did conform to bonus depreciation, which is expensing for machinery and equipment. So similar to what we're talking about with R&D expensing. The benefits too of better tax treatment aren't just confined to shareholders or owners of corporations. It's enjoyed by workers and employees and the rest of us in the economy.
Well, thank you very much for reminding me about a piece that I forgot I wrote a couple months ago, but it is pertinent to this discussion. And it's also pertinent to this discussion about or debate over raising the minimum wage, because, you know, here we have an example of where research is showing that certain types of tax policies, if done right, can lead to higher wages and more hiring. Naturally, as the economy responds and as businesses respond, and then people become more productive and they earn more and so forth. And that sort of natural, organic process that comes from a vibrant economy. Or you can try to force feed this into the economy by dictating that the minimum wage is going to be, let's say, $15. And we know, based on CBO's research, that will actually lead to, oh, yeah, some people will get a raise, but then, you know, 1.4 million people will get fired. And so that's kind of the wrong approach to this. And that's sort of the typical political approach, is to force things upon the economy rather than trying to get to smart, neutral tax policy that allows the economy to grow organically, allows productivity to grow organically, and eventually it raises living standards and quality of life for everybody. So thanks for reminding me of that paper and the research that came of it, because it really is an indication that, done right, tax policy can do as much, if not more, than trying to force feed the economy through regulatory policy. Well, thank you both very much. This has been a fascinating discussion. I appreciate it. And thanks to all of you for tuning in to The Deduction. We will be back soon with another interesting dive into the world of tax policy. Until then, be safe.
And that wraps up this episode of The Deduction. We'd love to hear what you think about this podcast. Please let us know at taxfoundation.org/podcast.